comments and views expressed on The Kevin Smith Show are those of the people that make them and do not necessarily reflect the views of Kevin Smith, The Kevin Smith Show, or its affiliates or sponsors.
Hi, folks, and welcome to The Kevin Smith Show. Whoever you are, wherever you are, all around this planet, thank you for being here at The Kevin Smith Show. And, there are a lot of places that you can go all over the world and all over the internet to listen to radio, but talk radio like nowhere else on earth is right here. And I'm delighted that you're here. I think you will be, too. After all, it is the show where you matter. Remember, on this Saturday, I will be in the chat room, Saturday evening at Showtime. On the first Saturday of every month, I go into the chat room in our members area, and I go in at Showtime. Now, I drop into the chat room from time to time, unannounced, and just chat for a few minutes and move on. But we have a regularly scheduled chat so that everybody knows when I'm going to be there. And it's the first Saturday of every month at Showtime. So whatever time it is right now in your time zone, if you're listening to this live, whatever time it is right now is the time to go to the chat room Saturday evening. Speaking of the members area, you know, this whole story that we've been following and have done three shows on now, the story of the Pickering brothers and their story, and then the group that decided they were going to investigate this story, and then the sub-story about that group arguing dividing, and then the stuff getting published. All of that is, I think, interesting, and certainly one of the hot stories so far this year. And what I've done, I've taken the, for those of you who are members, I've taken the videos of the three shows that we've done. Three shows in May, two shows in May, and one show on June 1st. So a total of three shows. We had the Pickerings, we had Bryce Weiner, and then we had Andrew Murray. Now, those three shows are in the Video Galaxy, and they're grouped together. Just go in there, open the Video Galaxy, and scroll down. You'll see them grouped together. And so if you missed any of those, you may go back and view them. They are there, okay? Also, now, if this is for everybody, not just members, this is for everybody. If you haven't subscribed yet to the K-Files, our free weekly newsletter, you need to do that. It's a good newsletter, and it's free, and there are no strings attached. You can unsubscribe anytime you desire to do so. So there's really no reason for you to not subscribe, is there? So go to my website, kevinsmithshow.com, scroll down, and you will see a link that says K-Files. Just click on that and subscribe. It's that simple, and in a few seconds, you will be moved from the mushrooms to the light. We'll be back right after this. Kevin Randall is a combat veteran of Vietnam and the Second Gulf War, having served in he was in the Army in Vietnam, and then after Vietnam, he was in the U.S. Air Force, and then during the Second Gulf War in Iraq, he served as a member of the Iowa National Guard. For his service in Iraq, he received a combat action badge for having participated in several firefights. And you would think that would be enough to keep a man busy. But somewhere over the past three decades, he also found the time to get a second master's degree, a PhD, and to be one of the most prolific writers in the field of UFOs. Now, he doesn't write exclusively about UFOs, but within the field of UFOs, he is one of the most prolific writers that we have. Kevin, welcome back to the Kevin Smith Show. We're delighted to have you.
And I'm delighted to be there. Or here, or somewhere.
Wherever we are, right?
Yes.
Yeah.
Undisclosed location.
Yeah. So secret, we don't even know where we are. Okay, let me begin, as I always do when I have any member of the service on the show, by thanking you for your service. And, you know, it's folks like you that put on the uniform and go out there and stand on the front line that make it possible for the rest of us to do what we do, and we thank you for that.
Well, I appreciate that. Thank you very much.
Kevin has a new book. For those of you who are watching, this is it. This is the book right here. It's called Crash, and the subtitle is When UFOs Fall from the Sky, A History of Famous Incidents, Conspiracies, and Cover-Ups. Kevin, I have enjoyed this book. Some of it, because it's history, you recount some things that we already know about, because that's the core of the story. But with each of these, you provide us with some different perspective, and in some cases some different information, or not different, but additional information that we didn't have. And there were a couple of things that were of particular interest to me. And I wonder if we could get you to kind of sketch it out for us a little bit for the audience. One of them is the information about Lydia Sleppy related to the Roswell incident. Now, this is something that I have always thought was just kind of a minor thing. It was no big deal. And yet, you came up with some additional information about Lydia Sleppy and the teletype machine that I think people ought to know.
I think what we need to do is kind of set the stage a little bit. Lydia Sleppy was the secretary, assistant station manager of a radio station in Albuquerque in July of 1947. She was on the telephone with Johnny McBoyle, who was a reporter at the station they owned in Roswell, and he'd been out seeing the crash craft, and that sort of thing. And he was relating over the phone to what she had seen, and she was typing it into the teletype machine to put it out over the AP wire, the UP wire, or the INS wire. I don't know which wire it was, but she was doing that. She said that the transmission was interrupted, and it said, "Do not transmit." Later she said, "This is the FBI, do not transmit." But the point was the transmission was interrupted. Well, the skeptical community, such as Carl Flock, said, well, that was impossible. There was no way to interrupt that. You'd have to throw a switch to receive this incoming message. And if you go back and you listen to her interviews, or you read the transcripts of her interviews, and you read the affidavit she produced, she tells you that. She says that there was a bell, and she flipped the switch for the incoming transmission. So the skeptical argument against her fails at that point, because she knew how it worked, and she said, yeah, that was how it worked. But more importantly than this, it turns out that Lydia Schleppi's story was told in a magazine in 1975 or 1976, 2 or 3 years before Jesse Marcel gave the information about the Roswell crash, years before we began talking about the Roswell crash, her story appears in a magazine, which is essentially that story, that she had been typing this thing out. So you can't say that she was contaminated. You can't say that she interjected herself into the story. You can't say she made it up because she was reading about all this other stuff. Her story actually appears years before everybody started talking about that. So it becomes that much more important because we're dealing with a story that now we can date to a specific time frame of the mid-1970s. So part of the skeptical argument against the Roswell case collapses, and part of the skeptical argument case against her collapses simply because we found documentation, and she explained to us in affidavits how that incoming message would have been received.
Well, what I thought was really interesting about it is that, you know, when you talk about part of the skeptical argument or skeptical case collapses, the flip side of that is the story, the core story about Roswell having been involved a craft that perhaps is extraterrestrial, but certainly something that all of these folks have not seen before. That core story is strengthened to the same degree that the skeptical story collapses.
Absolutely. We're able to document her talking about this long before it became the in thing to do. Granted, there have been people who've shown up since the books have been published, the documentaries have been produced, who were making up their involvement in the Roswell case. But here's a story that came out and is documented prior to all of that. So it's a very important little piece of information that we're able to now reveal basically for the first time in the book.
And you also, with the Roswell case, and the book, folks, the book is not about the Roswell case. It's about a bunch of different cases. And there's another one we'll get to in just a moment. But in talking about the Roswell case, you also told us about some more information. And I believe, I'm not sure I'll pronounce the man's name correctly, but it's General Cordes or Cordes.
Well, he was a lieutenant at the time in Roswell,
mm-hmm.
And unfortunately, we were unable to interview him for this work. But we did manage to talk to his widow, and we did manage to get some information from her, and she gave us a great deal of information about his military career, including his detail to the CIA. So here's a guy who was in intelligence work. He climbed up the military ladder to general officer status, which is very difficult to reach, as I'm sure you know,
mm-hmm.
And talks about his involvement in the Roswell case and what the way he and his wife actually are kind of involved. She was a bank teller who knew some of the ranchers in the area who talked a little bit about what was going on at this time, and she talks about the search for the dry ice so that they would be able to package up the what would be the biological samples, the alien bodies, and ship them off to Wright Field without the further deterioration of the corpses. So it's just another level of corroboration, because here is somebody who is talking about these sorts of things which you would expect if this event took place. And there's absolutely no reason for this woman to be making this story up. And she was somebody who was searched out. She didn't come forward with the tale. We had to go find her and talk to her and kind of drag the details out of her. So it becomes important for those reasons.
The dry ice thing is pretty interesting. The first time I heard about dry ice was in a videotaped interview with Glenn Dennis. And I'm not sure who did that interview. I can't even remember the date of the interview. But Glenn Dennis is the mortician. or funeral director, or I don't know what title he used, but anyway. And his story, of course, has come under a lot of fire. I think, I could be wrong about this, but I think it has been looked at with a very skeptical eye by one Kevin Randall as well.
Absolutely.
But in that interview, he talks about the dry ice, and that was his testimony in that interview was that he was called and by someone at the base, and they wanted to know how would he do various things, including how would you preserve tissue so that the chemical makeup of the tissue and so forth would be preserved. And he recommended that they go down to whoever's got some dry ice in town and buy the dry ice and pack the bodies in dry ice. Now, that's the first time I heard about that. And then when I was reading your book, I saw that part in there about General, is it Cords or Cordes?
Cords, I believe.
Cords, where his widow talked about she was trying to find some dry ice, and it had all been, they were two places she went, they said, well, you know, the military came through here and bought it all. Where did the story about the dry ice originate?
The first time I heard about the dry ice, I think it's from Glenn Dennis as well. And one of the things that we had done, and when I say we, I mean Don Schmidt and I, had found out who would have sold dry ice or been capable of making dry ice back in 1947. And we, their ice house still existed in 1990, 1991. And we went there looking for records from 1947. And they were able to find some records from 1922 and 1923 and some records from 1934 and from 1955, so the records were very sporadic, but we couldn't find anything from 1947, which would have been a nice bit of corroboration if we'd been able to do that. So that story has been around, and a couple of people had talked about transporting the bodies in dry ice. I believe Pappy Henderson also mentioned that sort of thing when he was when he told his wife, Sappho Henderson, about what was going on in the Roswell case, or what he had, his participation in the Roswell story was.
Okay, and then when you talked with General Cord's widow, this is information she volunteered about the dry ice had been bought up by the military, right?
Absolutely. One of the things that I try to do, I mean, I know what I'm looking for in the way of information when I'm interviewing a person. I know the story. And what I attempt to do is not feed them information for them to regurgitate to me. You have to be very careful, as you know, during an interrogation or a questioning, that you do not let the subject know what you would like to hear.
Mm-hmm.
And when I was interviewing Curry Holden, he was 96 years old, so I'm dealing with a very elderly man. And it's very easy to sometimes manipulate the conversations. So I'm thinking with Curry Holden, who talked about being out there having seen the craft and the bodies, when I'm interviewing him, I think if I'm going to feed him any cues, I'm going to feed him negative cues. I'm going to approach this from the negative point of view and ask my questions that way so that if I get positive responses, I know that he's not feeding me the information back or telling me what I want to hear. So you have to be very careful when you question people about these events. You don't give away the cues. So in this case, she, of course, was volunteering the information without me directing that in any way. One of the best examples of this is the firefighters. When Carl Flock did his anti-Roswell book, he had interviewed, he said, three firefighters from the Roswell Fire Department. He said, first of all, they didn't make runs outside the city limits. I had documents from the fire logs that showed that they did make runs outside of the city limits, so that wasn't true. But it showed no run by the fire department on the particular days that I needed. So a woman named Frankie Rowe had told us about her father, Dan Dwyer, who had been a lieutenant in the fire department at the time, and he'd seen the craft and he'd seen the bodies. So we're caught on this dilemma. How do you explain a firefighter out there and yet there's no record of it, and some of the firemen say, no, it never happened? Well, we found out that one of the firefighters was still alive, one of the guys that Carl Flock had interviewed. And we we called him, and I'm getting basically the same story that, that Carl Flock had gotten. Oh, we didn't make a run out there. Fire department didn't do this. And I asked him a critical question. I said, well, did you know Dan Dwyer? And at that point, he said, yeah, he took his personal car out there. And, I'm kind of flabbergasted by this because I didn't expect this answer. And the firefighter tells me what had happened is an officer from the base had come through and told him, don't worry about making a run out there. We've got it handled. You guys can relax. And Dwyer decided to take his personal car out there, which is what he did. He drove out there himself, and he was got close enough that he could see the craft and the bodies and described it to for his daughter, Frankie Rowe. So what happened is Carl I got what he wanted to hear from the guy and apparently ended the interview. I got the same stuff that Carl did, but I asked an additional question, which was simply, did you know Dan Dwyer? And I got the rest of the story for it and realized that there were two levels of this story. So the guys in the fire department basically didn't go out. This firefighter didn't go out, but his lieutenant, Dan Dwyer, had, and talked to him about it. They had been good friends in the past. So we were able to get that sort of information and bring it forward. So what we've done there, again, is kind of refute one of the skeptical arguments against the Roswell case simply by interviewing the guy carefully and asking all the questions we could think of.
You know, when you were talking about the firefighters didn't make runs outside the city, I was just thinking back when I was a deputy sheriff. This was years ago. I was much younger and had hair. And I was a deputy sheriff. And this was in northeast Louisiana, so what everyone else calls counties, they call parish. And so within the parish, you had two main towns. One was Monroe, one was West Monroe. And the city police in Monroe just policed in Monroe. And the same thing for West Monroe. They policed just in West Monroe. Unless one of us outside their city limits started calling for help and they were closest to us, they would leave the city and come to us to help us. All right, we have to step away for break. We'll be back. All right, welcome back. We're talking with Kevin Randall this evening, and so far we've been talking about the information in his latest book called Crash, When UFOs Fall from the Sky. Great book. You got to get it. It's very interesting. Kevin, I was just saying, you know, as you were talking about the fire department, and they don't make runs outside the city. That's been said. You know, way too often people make generalizations, or they make concrete statements based on general policies or general situations. And, you know, it's generally true the city police do not go outside the city. But there are circumstances in which they do. And you can't make a concrete statement that they don't, because they do. And the same, I would think, has to be true of the fire department as well. But in this case, it's absolutely true, apparently, that the fire department did not respond to this so-called Roswell crash. They didn't respond to it. However, a fireman did in his own personal car.
Exactly. And the one thing that the fire department, when I was there talking to him, I asked one of the top-ranking officers in the fire department, when I asked him about runs outside the city limits, his response to me is, what are we supposed to do, let it burn?
Right.
So if it was a situation where they were the only agency that could respond, they would do so, whether it was inside the city limits or outside. It may have been a policy in the 1950s, and Carl got his information from a councilman who'd been on the city council in the 1950s and said the policy was not to make runs outside the city limit. But that was irrelevant because it was the 1950s, and we could prove that in 1947 the fire department did in fact make runs outside the city limits. So, but the important point was, in this case, they were not required to make a run. They didn't make it. The story came about because one of the firemen did it on his own.
Mm-hmm. Well, and like I say, it's easy to say, and you can check up on what are the policies. But the policies are bent all the time because of circumstances. You know, we had a policy that if we were running code, we were not, this didn't last long, but we were not to run more than 15 miles an hour over the speed limit, and we had to have lights and siren on. And during that period of time, I made a run at 125 miles an hour. So the reason was we had an officer being attacked with a knife. And citizens were calling. Burned up the engine, too. That was an exciting day. I set that brand new engine on fire. But
In the military, you know, we have the rules and regulations that we follow and we live by. But I know any number of people who were in command positions who said the regulations are for the guidance of the commander, not to restrict his ability to command.
Yeah.
So yeah. We have to keep that in mind as well.
All right. I want us to move over to Kecksburg. Kecksburg, until recently, and when I say recently, I'm really, it's not recent, but about the last 2 years, has not really been too interesting to me. Kecksburg has always, to me, sort of been a ho-hum kind of a case. I really don't know why. It's just sort of like, yeah, okay. But within the past 2 or 3 years, it has picked up. And one of the things that always interests me is when evidence goes missing. And the court case over Kecksburg, where the judge ordered NASA to turn over their files on Kecksburg. And NASA drug their feet. They fought it. Then they drug their feet, and then said, we don't have any files. We can't find them. When the evidence goes missing, that's curious. And so I got really interested in it. In your book, you talk about Operation Moondust. And sketch that out for us.
Back in the very beginning of the UFO, the modern era of the UFOs, there was Project Sign, which was the official investigation started after the sightings of 1947. It evolved into Project Grudge, which was sort of a debunking effort by the Air Force, which then evolved into Project Blue Book, which began as a legitimate investigation. But the Air Force kind of felt that they didn't want to do it anymore, and they wanted to get off this or out of the UFO investigating business. So they commissioned the University of Colorado to study UFOs for a number of years, and the University of Colorado said, well, there's really nothing to it. There's no threat to national security. There's no reason to continue the investigation. But what they did was, so they closed Project Blue Book, but they created a new investigation, codenamed Project Moondust, which was a classified code name, and they continued to investigate UFOs. Now, Moondust was used for other stuff, and it was designed to pick up returning space debris or space debris of all unknown origin, which means Soviet or Chinese, or could mean extraterrestrial. So Moondust had a mission to look for strange debris and try to recover it for analysis, but it also had a UFO component, because when you got a hold of some of the Moondust documents, they were obviously UFO sightings. They were UFO reports. Interestingly, Senator Jeff Bingaman of New Mexico had written to the Air Force and said, tell me about Project Moondust. And the Air Force wrote back and said, no, there's no such project. Never happened. We don't have such a thing. When they were presented with the documents that had come from the State State Department, which had been released probably by mistake into the UFO community. The Air Force amended their statement and says, well, yeah, we had a moon dust, we just never used it. Well, the document showed that they had used it as well. Moon dust becomes important because they had created these three-man special reaction teams that went into areas where this returning debris had been found. And after within hours of the Kecksburg events taking place in December of 1965, we have good evidence that a three-man team was dispatched to Kecksburg, and there was additional information that another team out of Massachusetts was also alerted to go into Kecksburg. They never went, but they were alerted to go. Other military units were there. The state police talk about military there. The civilian witness talk about military there. So there's very good evidence that the military responded to the Kecksburg case, and Moondust would have been one of the agencies involved with it during that time, would have been what they were looking for.
One of the stories that was put out is that whatever it was that fell was most likely, and this one's still out there, was most likely a Soviet satellite or part of a rocket or something. However, reports out of NORAD tracked that into Canada. And there's several hours time difference as well.
Yeah, I was going to say, not only that, the I think it's was the Cosmos 96. It was a probe that the Soviets had launched to go to Venus, and the boosters failed, and the object never achieved a proper orbit and then returned to Earth. But the timing was wrong. I think the Cosmos 96 craft returned some 13 hours before the Kecksburg sightings were made. And you're right, the debris was found in Canada. The stuff in Kecksburg, of course, was found just outside the small town of Kecksburg, which is near Pittsburgh in Pennsylvania. So we know that something came down there. A reporter for a station there did a news report on it, a documentary type thing called The Object in the Woods, which still exists today. So you can go back and you can listen to this report that was put together about a week after the Kecksburg sighting. But there were a number of very credible witnesses involved in this thing who talked about the military presence into there. So something came down in the Kecksburg area, and the next question is, well, we need to determine what it was. And at this point, we don't have a real good answer.
You've been around the military for a long time. So you've seen a lot of things that probably the rest of us have not seen. When they describe this thing as being sort of acorn-shaped, does that sound like anything that you've ever seen?
No, absolutely not. And I think the reason they suspected the Cosmos 96 was not only the timing of the launch, but descriptions that came out of the Soviet Union at the time suggested there was a somewhat acorn shape to it, but nothing like what was described in Kecksburg. And the other thing, there was some, for the people who got down into the woods and saw this thing, there was some kind of writing around the bottom of the acorn that looked to some of them as if it was Russian, the Cyrillic alphabet. It wasn't, but that's what they kind of look like. And if you go back and you look at Cosmos 96, well, there was none of that around the external part of the craft. So that doesn't fit with the Cosmos 96 descriptions that we have. So the description of the craft and that sort of thing just really doesn't relate to anything that we've been able to identify in our inventory. And, of course, the Soviet inventory is wide open now now being the Russian inventory. So there was nothing there that they had that would have fit that description very well either.
Well, in your book, you make a point on the name Project Moondust. You make a point of showing where they didn't say they're not doing it anymore. They say the name has been changed.
And the new name is properly classified.
Mm-hmm.
The original project was compromised, and I think it was a mistake on the part of the State Department. Robert Todd and then Cliff Stone and eventually I had all sent FOIA requests to the Department of State asking for the moon dust documents or asking for documents about UFOs. I think Todd originally got the moon dust document or a document that said moon dust, and then he FOIA'd for anything relating to moon dust, as did Cliff Stone and I, so we got all kinds of documents like that about moon dust. But when, and I believe, it was Robert Todd who had asked what the new code name was, the response to him was that the new code name is currently classified and is properly classified. So as of it was the mid-1980s when a lot of this transpired. So as of then, we knew what the project was, but after that, we don't know what the code name was, only that it had continued and the new name was classified. We don't know what it was. And these kind of activities, what Moondust would have been engaged in is, of course, looking for the sort of debris that you'd expect with a UFO crash or some kind of catastrophic failure on the part of the UFOs, and that would be the sort of thing we'd want in the way of evidence so we could prove that these things were extraterrestrial in origin.
Well, and I believe the document that you quote in your book says that not only are they to look for it, but to retrieve it.
Yes, and there's a number of cases we know of where moon dust was used to retrieve stuff. Now, in a couple of the cases, we're pretty sure the material retrieved was of terrestrial origin, terrestrial manufacture, one of them.
Hate to do it, Kevin, but a break just took over. We'll pick up there when we come back, though. All right, folks, we'll be back. Welcome back to the Kevin Smith Show. My guest this evening is Kevin Randall. Kevin, I cut you off right in mid-sentence. I want to give you an opportunity to wrap up on the thought that you had going when I cut you off.
And can you help me out a little bit?
I don't remember. We were talking about Kecksburg and the...
stuff. And that we were... That there, the moon dust had been deployed a number of times. Mostly what they picked up was terrestrially manufactured debris, and there was a case from South America, and that's kind of where I was going, this thing was reported to have fallen out of the sky. The natives had found it. The American embassy recovered it under moon dust, and it looked to be like a external fuel tank for a aircraft of some kind. So clearly it wasn't of extraterrestrial manufacture, but that was when moon dust was supposed to do, pick up strange stuff and see if they could figure out what it was. So the mission was accomplished there at that time.
Okay, so you have been able to verify that moon dust personnel were sent to Kecksburg, right?
Yes.
Okay. So that verifies that there were military personnel there. Just like the witnesses said, you have a cop, I think he was a state trooper, that said he could see the light coming from something that had gone down in the woods.
There were a number of witnesses up on what is now called Meteor Road in the Kecksburg area, looking down into this forest, or this wooded area, I guess would be a better description, where the thing had landed. And there were police officers who said they could see the glow down there in the woods, and there were some civilians as well who said they saw the glow down there. So clearly something was going on down in the woods. There has been discussion that the military or maybe the fire department had set up some kind of lighting system down there, but we weren't able to find any evidence that was the case. So there was a glow down there reported by a number of people, including I believe they were state troopers as opposed to city police or something like that.
Mm-hmm.
Pennsylvania state troopers who were involved.
Now, what about the fire department? Do they admit going out on this one?
There were members of the fire department. Kecksburg, if I remember correctly, had a volunteer fire department at the time, and there was fire department personnel involved. But the fire station, the volunteer fire station, was taken over by the military and the state police as sort of a command post at the time. So I don't think that the fire department was directly involved in this. What we ended up with was the military, the state police being the people who were kind of running the show.
From your research into this, have you determined whether, from your point of view, they recovered anything?
There is stories about that from the witness that something was removed on a flatbed truck under a tarp. I have not been able to confirm with documentation that took place, but what we do know is there were any number of witnesses who talked about something being trucked out of the area under a tarp on a flatbed truck. And the descriptions of the thing that was recovered, the acorn-shaped craft, it was small enough in diameter that it could have been moved out on a just regular flatbed truck. No special equipment would have been involved. The one thing that always has kind of intrigued me about this is the movement of those sorts of things require quite a bit of coordination on the part of the military organizations who are doing it. It's not something you just say, go get in that truck and go out to the woods. There's a bit of a coordination that has to go on, especially when you're moving military equipment over civilian roads, which is not to say you can't move it. You just have to coordinate it a little bit better so you don't interfere with traffic and that traffic flow and that sort of thing. But this would have been basically a single flatbed truck and probably a couple of escort vehicles, so it wouldn't have been much of a convoy, and it wouldn't have taken a lot of coordination. It could have been done in a matter of a couple of hours, so there's no reason to reject the idea.
Right here in Arizona, just outside of Phoenix, something that was launched from, I think it was Fort Hood. Anyway, it landed here and out in the desert. And the news crew went out there. People were saying they can see something coming down. And they went out there, and it was coming down with a parachute. And it was just, you know, a big metal box-looking thing. And it turns out it was packed with scientific experiments. For upper atmosphere scientific experiments. And within an hour, I think less than an hour, the news crew filmed this. Here comes a flatbed truck and maybe one other vehicle. And they pulled up and started working to get this thing up on the truck. And the news asked them, well, what is it? And they told them. They said, well, it's scientific equipment. Checking for certain things up in the upper atmosphere. And the reason I tell this story is because they were tracking it. If they weren't tracking it, they couldn't have had that truck there that quick. If it was a surprise to them that this thing was coming down and where it was coming down, then this truck could not have been there that quick. And I wonder... based on that, I wonder, do you think that they were tracking this thing as it was coming down and knew where it was going to land?
I think once it entered the atmosphere, then they were kind of tracking it. I don't know how long the flight lasted. But as you were talking about that, it reminded me of the Needles, California crash of 2008 that George Knapp had investigated, where something fell early in the morning. There were a number of people around the Needles area who saw it, and the military was there within 20 minutes picking the thing up. Had a number of helicopters, including a big Sikorsky out there, picked this thing up and took it away. So clearly that was some kind of a military experiment. They knew where, if it had gone astray, they knew where it went, and they were prepared to go get it as quickly as possible. And in the Kecksburg thing, I don't think they reacted quite that quickly. It was many hours before they were able to get the flatbed truck in there. It was late, or early in the morning, I should say, before they got there. The thing fell around 5 o'clock in the afternoon, and it was after midnight before they could get out there to retrieve anything.
Where would something like that be taken, Kevin? If they retrieved it, where would that be taken?
The logical explanation would be Wright-Patterson Air Force Base, because that was where they would have the facilities for reverse engineering something like that, where when Belenko defected in his MiG-25, that eventually material went to Wright-Patterson Air Force Base. That was the facility to do it. In the Roswell case, we know an awful lot of stuff went Wright Field, Wright-Patterson at the time, based not only on what the witnesses at Roswell told us, but what the people at Wright Field told us at the time. So we know it got there. There is nothing to suggest that in 1965, after the Kecksburg thing took place, that it would have gone to the same location. So that would be the guess as to where the stuff went would be Wright Field. Now, it may have been piecemealed out to other facilities, not only on the base, but in other facilities that might have some kind of an expertise they could bring to bear on a specific type of debris or a specific type of instrumentation they found. But it would have been coordinated through Wright-Patterson.
All right. Now, the title of your book, I see we're going to run out of time probably. We'll have another break here. But the title of your book includes this subtitle, A History of Famous Incidents, Conspiracies, and Cover-Ups. Now, I have had a number of people on this show, like yourself, with years of service in the military. And they are as frustrated and baffled about the cover-ups as all the rest of us unwashed masses. When we come back, I want to ask you about who's orchestrating the cover-ups. We'll be back, folks, right after this. Welcome back to the Kevin Smith Show. For those of you just now joining us in this second hour, welcome. We're glad you're here. My apologies that we had to start so early, but we do it every night. And my sympathies to you if you had to miss the first hour. But thank you for being here now. And my guest is Kevin Randall. Kevin, when we went away for break, I said I want to talk about, and I want to hear from you, who you think is orchestrating the cover-ups. Now, let me give some structure to the question. We know that at Roswell, at first, there was no cover-up. At first, there was a press release. And they said, hey, you know, we've got a flying disc. Almost immediately, that was shut down, and General Ramey comes into the picture. There are several accounts of Ramey raising all kinds of holy hell over that press release. Don't know if that really happened, but there are some accounts of that. Ramey, by several accounts, a couple of accounts, orchestrated the cover-up, and the real debris was not shown to the press. It was a weather balloon that was shown to the press, and they made Jesse Marcel the scapegoat on the thing. but we see Raimi orchestrating that, except for this. I don't care if you are a general. You answer to someone. Now, we could say, well, then it's the president. But you see, we know that the presidents are not read into the UFO material. Not every president. They're not briefed on it. Some are, some are not. And that means there's someone else up there above the president. And that's hard for Americans to imagine. But there's somebody up there above the president that's orchestrating the cover-ups. Who?
If we look at the Roswell case, Blanchard would have been the man on the scene, Colonel Blanchard, and he's the one responsible for the press release.
Mm-hmm.
His higher headquarters was 8th Air Force, which was General Raimi. General DuBose, at the time he was a colonel, was Raimi's chief of staff. He said that the orders were coming from Washington, specifically Clements McMullen, who was, I think, the deputy commander of SAC at the time. At the time, SAC was based in Washington. Today, it's in Omaha. But their orders were coming from SAC. We understand, based on what General Exxon had told us, that those orders were coming down from the from Stuart Symington, who was the undersecretary for war, undersecretary for war in air at the time. He later became the undersecretary of air, the secretary of the Air Force. Symington later became a senator, but now we're into the civilian chain of command. Based on what Exxon told us, there was a committee established to control this information, and there was an intelligence component to it, there was a scientific component to it, there was a military component to it, and the top people in their various fields or the highest ranking officers in their various components were brought into this committee. In today's world, a lot of people talk about MJ-12. I don't think that's the right name for it, and some of the people who've been identified have not been identified on the MJ-12 committee. But there's an entity, a committee like that, who controls access to the information and is responsible for the continued research into the debris recovered, not only at Roswell, but these other events that took place in the years subsequent to Roswell.
Okay, now we say this committee is created. By who? By what entity?
According to what we've been able to find out, the president was the one who appointed the committee originally.
So this would be Truman, right?
That would be President Truman, yes.
Okay.
He would have been responsible for appointing the committee to exploit the find at Roswell. Once these things get started, these committees get started, they're really not a political animal. They're beyond the politics. And the only politician we've ever identified as being part of this was Stuart Symington. And at the time that he got involved with it, he was not a politician. He was part of the administration, part of the Truman administration. The other components were general officers who were involved, and like I said, in parts of the intelligence community, which would have been the Central Intelligence Group at the time, I believe, the forerunner to the CIA. Once these entities are established and the committee is established and they're funded, they go from administration to administration to administration, and the president doesn't necessarily know about the committee. That committee runs this specific aspect of it. And if anybody wants to say, well, that's just a lot of crap, these things never happened, there's a marvelous book called Operation Solo. And what that's about is a guy who had been a member of the American Communist Party in the 1930s, and as Stalin is assassinating everybody around him and purging people right and left, this guy became dissatisfied with the Communist Party. But working with the FBI, he maintained his party membership and became a very trusted man in the Communist Party. He would be invited to the Soviet Union all the time. He would meet with the top level of people in the Soviet Union. And this whole operation was run out of the New York FBI office. And most of the people who worked in the FBI office in New York didn't know about this, and the presidents didn't know about this. The information was that tightly controlled and that tightly held. The only president they ever told about Operation Solo, and this is all outlined in the book, was Ford, right after Nixon had resigned, and Ford was going to have to meet with the Soviet leadership, and he was very concerned about it, and so they sat down and they briefed him on Operation Solo so he would know that he was bargaining from a position of strength, that they knew what was going on in the highest levels of the Soviet Union. So this is sort of analogous to what happened with the UFO stuff. Yeah, the committee was originally appointed by the president. It was controlled by the president, but it takes on a life of its own, and suddenly it's sort of a separate entity. And if they determine they want to let the president know, well, they do. And if they don't want him to know, they don't tell him a thing about it. And you've got to be able to ask the right questions to get to it, to learn about it. And the presidents may not know what questions to ask, or they may be smart enough not to ask those questions because it might be something they don't want to know. But there is a historical precedent for this sort of a committee to exist.
Okay. Now, the first, I'm going to call it MJ-12 because I don't know what else to call it. I understand that may not be the correct name, but we understand within the context of this conversation that it's that committee. Okay, so MJ-12, the first one, is appointed by Truman. So he's in charge of who goes on to that committee. These days, if it's running itself, who appoints the people that are going to be on there?
The guy in charge of the committee, whoever he would be. By the way, just so you know, Exxon called the committee the Unholy 13 because he didn't know the name either. And that was the name he applied to it, which is not an official name or anything like that. It was just a way of that he had for referring to it. But this would be an autonomous committee. They would select the people they think would be of value to the committee, or if there was a specific avenue of research they needed to explore, they would get the top guy in that. If the top guy was agreeable to, I mean, they would approach him very carefully and suck him into this thing. And if he didn't want to do it, they'd go to the next guy without telling them really what was going on until they found someone they knew they could trust and who was willing to live by their rules. So the committee becomes autonomous in that way. They're able to sort of reproduce themselves as the years go by. If something happens in a specific environment and the president would have to know, then they would brief him, this is what you need to know to react to this specific situation. And if there's no situation like that, then there's really no reason for the president to know. I mean, if we look at the world today and where President Obama is, he doesn't really need to worry about flying saucers. He needs to worry about oil spills, health care, and the other things going on that are more immediate than dealing with the flying saucer situation. Flying saucer situation is not requiring immediate response today, but these other things are. So the president can do his job and function as the leader without having to know about that. And I suspect there's lots of things like that that the president doesn't know about, but there are committees and there are groups that control that sort of thing. And if that moves to the forefront, then that expertise is called upon.
Do you think that this, the existence of a committee that when it comes to UFOs, extraterrestrial technology, a committee that is in absolute control of that information and is not answerable to anybody, even in terms of who gets to be on the committee, they determine it for themselves, and yet they're funded by taxpayer money. Do you think that somehow fits in our Constitution?
Well, obviously it doesn't fit in the Constitution, but there's all sorts of black budgets, as you well know.
Mm-hmm.
It was $30 billion in the CIA black budget. They're really not accountable to anybody for that money. How much money has disappeared? How much money disappeared in Iraq? We used to have a joke over there. You're calling into the tactical operations center. Says, we just found a stockpile of $50 million, $46 million, $33 million, $12 million. You know, we're picking it up and hiding it away in other things, so you turn in part of the cash. I mean, there were truckloads and I mean semi-truck loads of cash, that were discovered in Iraq in billions of dollars. And one of the things they were doing with the Iraq is what they called foo money, and they would distribute it to the American units and say, use this money to buy some luxury items for the soldiers that they may not be able to afford for themselves. So the money was being used for the betterment of the experience of the soldiers in Iraq, and another was spent on the Iraqi people. But I mean, there's just carloads of money that are spent without any real accounting. So that's not a real impossibility. But the other thing that strikes me is we're dealing with a technology that's far superior to ours, and we may not be able to understand it. So we've got the warehouse full of this stuff, and as our technology evolves, we may apply that to some of this stuff to see if we can figure out what it is and how it works. But it may not cost a lot of money to do that. It may just be, well, this area of research seems to fit with this area in the crashed retrieved saucer. Let's apply that, but it might not cost more than $500,000 to do. And that's, when you're talking billions and billions of dollars, $500,000 is a drop in the bucket.
Mm-hmm. Well, I don't know. I just think that most Americans expect that the term commander-in-chief means commander, which means then that there should be, if this truly is a constitutional republic, no organization in the military or the intelligence community or anywhere in the government that can tell the president, no, you can't know that. If he wants to know, I think constitutionally, anybody that says no to him is an enemy of the Constitution. And I think everyone in uniform, both military and police, have taken an oath to arrest that person.
And I don't think they're saying no to the president. I think if the president wants to find out, you're right. If the president wants to find out, and I've said this all along, if I'm the president and I want to find something out, and I say, General, tell me about this, and he says, well, no, sir, we can't. It's classified. I say, General, you're fired. Get your deputy in here, and we'll chat with him.
Mm-hmm.
Not a problem with that. I think it's a more subtle thing than that. I think what's going on here is this information, this part of the research is so incredible that a lot of people don't believe that it exists, which helps them hide it, and that the presidents don't normally ask questions about this. So it's allowed to continue its function without presidential interference, which is a terrible term, but without presidential interference.
Mm-hmm.
If the president wants to learn about this stuff, I believe that he can. But I also think that without it being something that is very important in the running of the world today, that's put on the back burner. They're not paying attention to that sort of stuff because there's all these other things that require the immediate attention of the president. So they're kind of hidden behind all the you might say, the important stuff, fixing the spill in the Gulf, fixing dealing with the Taliban in Iraq, dealing with health care, dealing with all these ancillary issues that are at the front of the front of everybody's mind, and UFOs fall way at the back, and the president just really doesn't have time to deal with that. If something happens, a UFO falls out of the sky, and it becomes now a priority thing, well, the president can get to that information, but it's not necessary for him to know it today to do his job.
Well, I would think that I agree with you, but I would think that if you look at the real crisis that oil is causing, we've got this crisis in the Gulf. It's a potential, it isn't yet, but potentially it could be an extinction level event. So that's a crisis. Look at the crisis that oil causes in economies. And if there exists advanced technology that could take us off of oil, even partially, And it's hidden deep in the folds of this secret world, governed by this secret organization that answers to nobody. I would think that's a front burner issue for the president. Let's get that out there. Let's solve this oil problem. But I could be wrong. All right, we're going to open up the telephone lines and invite our audience to give us a call and join us in this discussion. Now, if you have a question or a comment for Kevin, that would be Kevin Randall. The telephone number is 623-444-5889. In the United States and in Canada, we have a toll-free number for you. It is 888-223-4599. You can call either one of those numbers. If you can call me without it costing you long distance, please use 623-444-5889. If you're outside of the USA and you're outside of Canada, that telephone number will work for you, but it's not toll-free. And if you don't want to make an international long-distance call and you're outside of the USA, you're outside of Canada, you can use the flash message option on my website, kevinsmithshow.com. Just go there and scroll down. You'll see where it says flash message. Caller, you are live on the Kevin Smith Show. Your first name and from where are you calling?
Hi, Kevin. This is Charles from Georgia.
Hello, Charles.
I'm going to ask Kevin, before, just in case nobody else does, if he's familiar with James Horak or not.
The name's familiar. Right now it escapes me.
He is the one that claimed that he caused the spacecraft at Roswell to crash using his mind. And I think both craft. And I was just wondering if you were familiar with that.
First of all, I think there was only one crash, not two.
I'm not talking about the one at the Brazel Ranch and the one further on. Is it two I was talking about?
Well, the Brazel Ranch, I think there was a number of different sites, and it was as the craft came apart. We talk about a second craft over in the plains of San Augustine. I don't accept that the second crash took place. But
okay.
If this guy's got the power to bring down spacecraft with his mind, there's a lot of stuff he could do to help out the world, and how come he's not doing it?
I'll let Kevin give you a little synopsis of him. He did better than I can, but I just had to bring his name up, and I'll go back to listening now. Thank you.
Okay, thanks for the call. Yeah, James Horak is a man who is a guest on this show from time to time, and he always says amazing things. Some of them make a lot of sense, and some of them, you know, you have to raise an eyebrow and think about. If this show wasn't bringing you information that's a bit controversial, would you listen? I wouldn't. You know, ice cream with no flavor is not ice cream. Okay, caller, you are live on the Kevin Smith Show. Your first name and from where are you calling?
Hey, Kevin and Kevin, this is Sam from Lake Havasu City. How you doing?
Great. How are you, Sam?
I'm doing well. Doing well, Kevin. Listen, Kevin, I just have a question. I know the Roswell incident, it seems to be beaten to death, but answers are important. And a thing that's always puzzled me is in the radio recording of Roswell, the initial report comes on, he says a flying disc has been recovered, there's a little excerpt about some other news, and then they go to break, and then he comes back and says the flying disc was recovered, the Army won't give out any details about the missile, he says real quick. But he didn't say that the first time. And then there's another break, and the guy says, stay tuned for the news headlines. And then he comes back again and starts saying that the disc was discovered. They're waiting at Wright-Patterson for the debris. The Army official there said it hasn't arrived yet. But they said it looked like tinfoil and balsa wood. I mean, that sounds to me like that was built as he was doing the report. I mean, it sounded to me like it was built or he was coerced into saying that. What are your thoughts on that?
If we take a look at the chronology of the Roswell crash and the stories, and there was an article that appeared in the Daily Illini, which I believe is a student newspaper at the University of Illinois, it gives a chronology of how the bulletins went out over the various wires during July 8, 1947. You first had Walter Hott's press release saying that they had a flying saucer and Jesse Marcel was taking it to Fort Worth. Then you had a period of time where there wasn't a lot going on. Then it arrives at Fort Worth. And then around 5:30 p.m., you start hearing stories that, well, it's a weather balloon, it's some kind of research device, we don't need to worry about it, and it shows up in General Ramey's office as a weather balloon. There's a FBI telex from 6:18, I believe, that night, saying that they're taking it on to Wright Field for analysis. It hasn't gotten there, but there's a suggestion, telephonically suggestion, that it's a weather balloon. I think what happened was the guys in Roswell said, hey, we got a flying saucer. 3 hours later, after Washington, D.C. got involved in all of that, they said, we got to stop all this query. There's too much information, or there's too much information getting out. There's too many people interested in it, and General Ramey is ordered to produce this weather balloon. So I think what the news reporter is doing, and I think it's the 10 p.m. edition of the news that night where we're doing that stuff. And he's just giving the information as it had developed during the evening. It's not as if he'd said something on the air and then suddenly somebody came in and said, no, you can't say that. So I think it's just an evolution of the a story during the day as the Army and the government was trying to get a handle on it. I think that's why we get those sorts of things when the headline editions, I guess, is what it was. They did on ABC News that night. So I think that's what happened.
All right, we have to step away for a break. And Sam, thank you for the call. Excellent question. We'll be back, folks, right after this. Welcome back to the Kevin Smith Show. My guest this evening, Kevin Randall. And Kevin, let's go to the telephone. Caller, you're live on the Kevin Smith Show. Your first name and from where are you calling?
Yeah, good evening, gentlemen. It's Terry from Ohio.
Hi, Terry.
Hi. I see, ever since Roswell, I don't know if it was before that or not, but basically it all started with them where the government took it upon itself, I don't know at what level, that they're going to name something, top secret, what would they call it, not in the best interests of the, United States, and make it top secret, no matter what it is. And there is no oversight committee, to overlook this information to see whether it is something that is something that should be kept top secret.
There's no check on their power.
Pardon me?
There's no check on their power.
Exactly. Mm-hmm. And we're stuck in this. We made this monster, and it's not going to go away soon. And I know you had a guest on a while back about talking about, we don't want aliens to come down here and, and tell us how to live and stuff. But we do need help in dismantling of this cabal, whatever it is, these overlords that think they, know what's in all of our best interests.
I don't think we need help. And Kevin, if you disagree with me on this, feel free to chime in. I don't think we need help at all, Terry. You, me, and over 300 million others of us in this country, we are the power. We're just too lazy and too stupid to do it. Now, here's the deal. this committee came into existence and the secrecy was authorized by means of an executive order. It only takes an executive order to end it.
Yeah, but none of our presidents are going to do that.
Well, that's because we keep electing. That's because we keep electing presidents that are part of the same club.
Yeah, because I mean, Bill Clinton, he wanted to do it, and he learned real quick to shut up.
Well, you know, as long as you elect presidents that all come from the same club, whether they're Republican or Democrat, they're all cut from the same bolt of cloth. And as long as you keep putting those people in, you keep getting the same results. And I've said this many times, you know, you can't do the same thing again and again and again and expect you're going to get different results. But a president could sign an executive order to dismantle the committee, to dismantle the secrecy, and to put it all back in the hands of the oversight of the Congress. He could do that. Kevin, what do you think?
You said to chime in if I disagreed with you, and I don't. So it's exactly right. If the president wanted to dismantle the oversight committee, he has the power and the ability to do so. It's just that I think that they keep him too busy chasing other ghosts, if you will, that this doesn't come to the forefront. He's busy doing other stuff. There's always something else that takes his attention away from that, and they're allowed to go on. But I'll also say something about the oversight committee that deals with the UFOs. I think we're at a point where things are fairly stagnant. Nothing's really going on. The technology that we can exploit, we've exploited. We do not understand the rest of it, and until there's a breakthrough in our technology so we can understand theirs or something else happens, we're pretty much left with a stagnant. Well, it's interesting stuff. We just don't know how to make it work. So I think that all combines to keep a lot of this under wraps.
Yeah, I think that's true. Terry, thank you for the call. 623-444-5889 is the main number here in the studio. And if you are outside of the USA and you're outside of Canada, that number will work. But if you're outside the USA and Canada, you can also use our flash message option on my website. All right, caller, you're live on the Kevin Smith Show. Your first name and from where are you calling?
This is Mike from Coral Springs, Florida.
Yeah, Mike.
How you doing, Kevin?
Both of us are doing well.
Okay, did you know your sound's off on your radio, can't get it on the Internet?
No, but I'm not surprised. Are you?
No, not at all, but I'll ask my question anyway.
Mm-hmm.
I got into the show late. I just got home from work. I don't know if this question's been asked for Kevin. I was wondering what Kevin thought of Joseph Farrell's book, Roswell and the Reich. Have you read the book, Kevin?
No, in fact, it was just Don Ecker pointed it out to me this morning for the first time. What I said to Don Ecker, I'll say it to you. It's interesting. Nick Redfern did a book that suggested the Japanese were responsible for Roswell and their Unit 731, and now we have the Nazis responsible for Roswell, and I'm pretty sure the Italians are going to show up at some point, so the Axis is all involved. To me, based on the research I've done, what happened at Roswell was extraterrestrial. It wasn't Earth-based, it wasn't Nazis, it wasn't Japanese, it was extraterrestrial in origin. And I lay out in my book, Crash, exactly why I believe that at Roswell. But it also talks a lot more than just Roswell. And I have not looked at that book. I do know that some of the arguments he makes are based on the skeptical arguments raised by some people who didn't do their research and their information was wrong, and he uses that to kind of bolster his point of view that the Nazis were involved, and I think it may be something that's built on a very shaky foundation.
All right, let me just say this. But I asked Don Schmidt about that a couple of years ago when Nick Redfern came out with his book, as you mentioned, and he said if it was from the paperclip people, we would have known exactly where it was, and you know, it wouldn't have been a surprise. It wouldn't have been some rancher telling us, you know, telling the military about it. But because what he says is, he says there was a group of Nazis that got down into Argentina, that they had that it came basically from there, or Antarctica or whatever. That group of Nazis was the one he says is responsible for what happened in Roswell. That's at least what he says, Kevin. So,
but the next question is, if the Nazis had access to this technology, why didn't they use it to win the war?
Well, maybe they didn't have it. But basically, maybe it wasn't quite up to where they needed to have it. I heard that, you know, things were kind of incomplete. Some of the plans were still going on, that type of thing. So maybe they got it done after the war. And his contention is, you know, that if it came from Argentina or someplace like that and it wasn't part of the paperclip crowd, they wouldn't have known about it. That's what he said.
But on the other side of the coin, in the witnesses that I've interviewed, the people I spoke to specifically who were there, who saw the debris, who Edwin Easley comes to mind as the provost marshal, some of the other officers on Blanchard's staff who was there, if it had been terrestrially manufactured, they would have known that. They wouldn't be telling us that this was something that was extraterrestrial in origin. They would have known. They may not have been able to identify the specific place it came from, but they would have known that it was Earth-based technology and Earth-based an Earth-based event. And of every member of Colonel Blanchard's staff that I was able to talk to, they all said it, with one exception, I should say, all said it was extraterrestrial. It was something from outside the world. Jesse Marcel, I've got a bit of videotape of Jesse Marcel Sr. saying it was something that came to Earth, but it was not of Earth. And so these are the guys who were there on the scene looking at it, who saw the stuff, and their opinions, I think, should take the top rung here when we're trying to figure out what happened. And if they're of the opinion it was extraterrestrial, then I think that carries a lot of weight.
All right. Mike in Florida, thank you for the call. Now, we have a flash message from Ross in the United Kingdom, and he wants to know if you know of any equivalent to the Majestic 12 in the UK or any other black ops stuff going on over in the UK.
I really don't. I've talked to Nick Pope about this. He was in the Ministry of Defense over there for a while and ran the UFO desk. I've talked to him a little bit about this. He would be the guy to ask about that. My research is concentrated on the United States, and I know that there was cooperation between the United States and the United Kingdom on UFO stuff, but I really don't know of a specific organization that would, an oversight committee, in the United Kingdom that would match what we've got here. So I guess my answer is I really don't know, but Nick Pope would be the one to ask.
You know, you've got quite a military career in three branches of the service. And you retired as a lieutenant colonel. During all that time, or at least as far as I can determine, during all or most of that time, you were active in looking into UFOs and writing about UFOs. Did you ever run into any problems over that?
No. And what's interesting is, given that I was both in Air Force intelligence and Army intelligence before I became a military policeman, I required a top secret clearance. And it turns out that the fellow who was responsible for conducting the background check on me lived across the street from my father. And he said that as they gathered the information about me for the articles that I had written for magazines, two of them very critical of the Air Force investigation of UFOs was in the file. So here was a perfect opportunity to kind of stick it to me, but I got the top secret clearance. I never had a problem getting a top secret clearance or anything else like that. So the answer would be no. The only thing that, when I went on active duty after 9/11 with the Army, they just said, if you're writing about UFOs, don't use your rank. And I thought, well, that's kind of a reasonable request. Don't have a problem with that. And now that I'm retired, well, I'm back free to say, hey, I was a lieutenant colonel, so I can do this stuff.
Well, and we can also, instead of saying Lieutenant Colonel Kevin Randall, we can say Dr. Kevin Randall now.
We can do all of that if we so desire.
Yeah. Or we can just say Kevin.
How's it going?
All right, from George in Australia, he wants to know, Kevin, have you ever considered that the cabal factions pulling the strings behind the scenes on our planet are actually just implementing the agenda of their off-world overlords? If you do, then all these agendas just fit together like a jigsaw puzzle. It's critical to think big in order to grasp the bigger picture. So what do you think about that, Kevin?
Well, first of all, I'd like to say that I enjoyed my leave in Australia when I was there. It was a very nice place, and I'd love to visit again. But my research has been at a different level than looking at the overall picture, I think, that he wants to talk about. And I've seen nothing in my research to suggest that there's any communication between the alien races out there and the governments of Earth.
All right, we have to step away for break. We'll pick up there when we come back. We'll be back, folks, in just a moment. Welcome back to the Kevin Smith Show. And I do understand that it's been pretty interesting. One of our radio feeds, we have multiple feeds, and one of them has been attacked a couple of times during the show tonight. However, over the other feeds, it's getting out, and besides that, you can always listen to the latest show or watch the latest show, and the morons are not going to keep us silent. My guest is Kevin Randall. Kevin, you know, I have no idea if there are alien overlords pulling the strings. I don't know. I mean, I hear people talk about it. I don't know. But it's not the alien overlords that are going to be held responsible for the actions of whoever string is being pulled. You know, that defense was tried at Nuremberg. Didn't work. And when people violate basic human rights, when people violate, in this country, violate constitutional rights, I don't care what their reason is, your defense cannot be, well, he told me to do it. It may be that he told you to do it, but you did it. And so these people that violate basic human rights and that violate, in this country, the Constitution, need to understand it's not any overlords and it's not your upward chain of command that's going to be held responsible. It's you. And you will be held responsible. Sooner or later, people have enough of having your foot on their throat. The fight's on. And you will be held responsible. That's what this country was born on revolution. And I'm not in any way saying that I am for an armed revolution. That's not what I'm talking about here. But that revolutionary spirit is still in lots and lots of Americans, most Americans. And when they get tired of having your foot on their throat, there's a payday. And so, you know, I think all these people that have done things that are anti-constitutional and that have wrecked people's lives and even harmed people physically sometimes in order to keep this secret of UFOs, well, the structure that's keeping it secret is unconstitutional. And sooner or later, you're going to pay. Now, Kevin, I'm going to give you the opportunity to refute what I just said.
And I would refute it. Why?
Okay, so you agree with that?
Absolutely. I do not know why the secrecy, why this is so wrapped in secrecy. All I can tell you is the documentation proves it. Some of the documentation is laid out in my latest book. Some of it is laid out in other books. But the documentation is there to demonstrate that this idea of UFOs was suppressed by the government starting right after the Roswell crash in 1947, and it persists today. I can't tell you why it persists today. I don't know why it continues to persist today. I don't know what the excuse is for it, but I can point to all sorts of documentation and all sorts of things that are going on that prove it. In the mid-1990s, we had the government who'd said, or the Air Force said, well, we don't investigate UFOs, but they investigated the Roswell case again. They came up with the same answer that they had in 1947. Why is it so important for the Air Force to keep that information under wraps? Why can't they tell us what really happened there? I don't know. All I know is they continue to do it.
Well, you know, one of the most telling things, I think, that stands up and screams that the Air Force lied about it being a weather balloon, they lied about it being Project Mogul, is that a piece of the material was sent to the Battelle Memorial Institute for them to try and duplicate it, for them to figure it out. You know, it was the metal-looking stuff that you could just crumple in your hand, and then you open your hand, and the stuff would resume its shape with no wrinkles, no crinkles. And Battelle was given this piece of material to analyze and try to duplicate it. Well, if we built it and we knew what it was, then we wouldn't be trying to figure out what it was and trying to duplicate it. Did you find any reports on the Battelle thing?
We haven't, and when I say we, the people I normally work with haven't looked at Battelle. I know that some work has been done, and there's some interesting things that have surfaced from the Battelle reports. What we were able to do was establish through General Exxon some of the work that had been done at Wright Field, and he said at the time that the people he knew who were involved in the study of this stuff didn't know what it was, didn't know how it was made, and said basically the same thing about the bodies recovered. They didn't know what they were, just that they were not human. So we've got some very good information like that. Once we get beyond that, the trail goes a little bit cold, and it's harder to get information out of it. And it takes somebody who is focused on a very small aspect of the case to chase those things down. I've been chasing for 10 years the documentation that the Secretary of the Air Force would have given to the guys who were doing the who did the Roswell investigation in the mid-1990s, and I keep going in circles. They tell me, well, it should be here, it should be here, it should be here, and I eventually get back to the first person that I started with, and we can't seem to put our hands on those documents, but they should be out there. The Secretary of the Air Force gave specific orders to the guys running the investigation. They must have had meetings. They must have talked about it. All of that stuff should have been documented. I have not been able to find any of it, and the documentation that I finally did get was a lot of stuff that was irrelevant. And in fact, one of the things that we did get was a big report that had been by the Fund for UFO Research about the Roswell case. Well, that's not the kind of thing I need. I could buy that from the Fund for UFO Research. What I need is the documentation internally in the Department of the Air Force that talked about this sort of thing, the directions they were given, how those questions were asked. Colonel Richard Weaver went out to see Sheridan Cabot, who was the counterintelligence agent in Roswell in 1947. And it's clear from the interview that they talked about what they were going to discuss before they turned on the recorder. But there's one point where Weaver asked Cabot what he saw. And he said, well, that was parts of a weather balloon. and they go on from there. And I'm thinking the next question should have been, did you communicate this rather vital piece of intelligence to either Jesse Marcel or Colonel Blanchard? I mean, you knew immediately it was a weather balloon, and yet you said nothing to these guys, and they announced that they've got a flying saucer. Why didn't you tell them that it was a weather balloon if you knew that? But Weaver never asked that question, which I think is critical. And that kind of tells you what's going on here. They were manipulating the information to continue the cover-up, and I cannot get to those documents to find out more about that.
We're almost out of time, so I've got time for kind of a yes or no answer. Do you think we're going to ever get the truth out of the government on this?
No.
I didn't think so.
but that is not to say we won't get to the truth, because the aliens also control part of it, and if they decide to land in Washington, D.C., well, then the government can't suppress the information anymore. So it's not just up to the government. The aliens also control part of it.
Absolutely true. Kevin Randall, thank you for being with us this evening, and if you will, stay on the line with me for just a moment. Okay, folks, you know you can click his picture on my website. It'll take you to his website, and I think you'll enjoy it. We have already had a stellar week so far. We've got more. You don't want to miss any of it. My friends call me Steel Eye. My enemies do too. You can call me whatever you want to call me. Just keep coming back again and again and again. Until next time, so long, everybody. Still with me? Yeah, I had to run and get rid of some of this coffee I've been drinking.